This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, April 27, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear from Iraqis testifying at a forum in Washington, D.C. Demonstrators in Colorado force representatives from the world's largest gold mining company to meet with them. And we'll check in on some of the massive boycotts, marches, and rallies planned for Monday. All that and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, expressed serious concern today over the situation of thousands of people recently displaced by military airstrikes in northern Sri Lanka. The UNHCR's representative in Sri Lanka, Amina Wad, said today that UN agencies are working with NGO partners to determine the immediate needs of the displaced and to provide a coordinated humanitarian response. A Senate-led investigation of the response to Hurricane Katrina has concluded that the Federal Emergency Management Agency should be shut down. A report released today by a Senate committee says FEMA should be replaced by a National Preparedness and Response Authority. The proposed agency would remain under the Department of Homeland Security, but would have more autonomy, and its leaders would report directly to the president. The report blamed FEMA for ignoring warnings, lacking preparation plans, and responding inadequately to the hurricane and subsequent flooding. Investigators found that FEMA's inefficiencies stemmed from a loss of authority, a lack of funding, and incompetent leadership. The report also criticizes the leaders of New Orleans, the state of Louisiana, and the Department of Homeland Security. An investigation by European Union parliamentarians has concluded that European territory was used by the CIA for the practice of so-called extraordinary rendition. Their report says that the CIA is guilty of kidnapping and illegal detention of terrorist suspects. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
European parliamentarians who've investigated the practice of extraordinary rendition have not just confirmed that more than 1,000 secret flights operated over EU territory in the last 5 years. They're also suggesting that some European governments knew about the flights. But Britain's Foreign Secretary Jack Straw still maintains there's no material evidence to prove that the US used British airspace for that purpose. Member of European Parliament Sarah Ludford was involved in the European Union investigation.
Certainly, if there has been breaches of international law, then we would expect the police and the judicial authorities of the member states to take an interest. There's a great deal of both parliamentary and judicial interest across the EU. It's an opportunity for parliamentary and human rights Europe, civil society Europe, to pull together and to call our governments to account for anything that they might have done.
The European Parliament now has to decide what other steps and possible sanctions should be taken. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The House Energy and Commerce Committee approved a telecommunications reform bill yesterday, rejecting two provisions that would have preserved the unbiased flow of traffic on the Internet, known as net neutrality, and an amendment to ensure that advanced cable and internet services are made available to all. The reform will open the door to the creation of a tiered system, allowing internet service providers to demand extra fees for websites that occupy more bandwidth. Opponents of the new legislation say it will end the nature of the internet as we know it. The telecommunications reform bill will next go to the House floor for a vote before it can proceed to the Senate. The highly anticipated cross-examination of Ken Lay is now underway in Houston. Lisa Cohen reports from the Enron trial.
After weeks of often dull testimony and the occasional sleeping juror, the Enron trial came alive Wednesday afternoon when the cross-examination of Ken Lay began. Observers in the overflow room cheered as Lay, former CEO, was moved to raise his voice immediately by prosecutor John Houston's surgical questioning. Lay denied the prosecutor's allegation that he tried to contact people on the government witness list just before they were scheduled to appear. He admitted he was asked by an attorney for Goldman Sachs, employer of two witnesses, not to try and contact them again. Today, a kinder and gentler Lay continues to evade responsibility for Enron's demise by blaming short sellers, who his attorney called vultures, only to be confronted with evidence that his own son, Mark Lay, was a short seller of Enron stock in 2001, the year of Enron's bankruptcy. Lay said he was unaware of this. Ken Lay is charged with 6 counts of conspiracy, wire, and securities fraud, and will likely remain on the stand through Monday. From KPFT, I'm Lisa Cohen for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
A Senate committee is an impasse over legislation on the NSA spying program. Democrats oppose going forward on 3 proposed bills, saying information on the proposal is inadequate, while committee chair Arlen Specter said he'll introduce legislation that would stop funding the NSA. Meanwhile, the House passed an intelligence bill that critics say expands executive powers. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
Civil liberties groups and those critical of the president's NSA spying program have been saying that legislation is futile if the details of the program are not yet known. Democrats took that position and opposed the passage of draft legislation out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
To pass legislation now is like a doctor diagnosing a patient without seeing the patient or seeing the records of the patient. And I'm strongly opposed to it.
The American Civil Liberties Union applauds Democratic efforts to halt the legislation. Caroline Fredrickson is with the ACLU.
Senator Feinstein from California could not have framed it more accurately. So we think they should investigate before they legislate.
Senator Feinstein is a member of the Select Intelligence Committee receiving briefings on the NSA program by the administration. She is dissatisfied with the information she has received so far. But Republican Orrin Hatch from Utah, also a member of the Select Committee, says he is pleased and he believes the program is lawful.
Anybody who can think this through at all knows that the current FISA language will not take care of allowing Congress and the courts to do what Congress and the courts, generally would like to do.
The president defends the program by saying he has inherent powers to authorize it. Critics say it could be unconstitutional and that the courts of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act should not be bypassed. The 3 bills proposed in the Judiciary Committee so far include one that would allow the FISA courts to determine the need for the program. The second would provide Congress with more oversight, and the third would put it on a fast track to the Supreme Court for them to decide the constitutionality. Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter is deeply concerned with the expansion of presidential powers and the administration's disregard for congressional authority. He doesn't understand the lack of outrage over the program.
You have as important a consideration on national security and fighting terrorism contrasted with civil liberties as I have seen. Historically, I can't think of a more important confrontation that this country has faced.
To test people's complacency, he plans to introduce an amendment that would stop all funding for the NSA. Ranking Member Patrick Leahy from Vermont has been calling for a subpoena of administration officials with knowledge of the program to testify. But Senator Specter says it won't do any good because they won't answer any questions. Meanwhile, the House overwhelmingly passed an intelligence authorization bill that will set funding and policy initiatives for the intelligence agencies. House Select Intelligence Committee Chair Peter Hoekstra from Michigan.
We want an intelligence community that is more than one step faster than the former Soviet Union. We want one that is going to be effective against the targets we face today, the targets that we face in the near term, and the targets that we are going to face in the long term. This is another successful building block in getting us to that goal.
Critics oppose the bill because provisions were rejected that would provide congressional oversight of the NSA spying program. Jane Harman, ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, who was also briefed by the administration on the NSA spying program, said she voted against this annual bill for the first time in 12 years because it fails to check the president's expanded powers. The legislation also dissuades intelligence employees from leaking information to the press by threatening to take away their pensions and imposing other repercussions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Members of the Out of Iraq Caucus held a second forum today to discuss ending the war. The forum is a response to a previously failed attempt by the Democrats to convene a full debate and vote on the war. Two Iraqi citizens and one U.S. doctor who served as a Navy hospital corpsman during the invasion testified at today's forum. Anastasia Genetsditska reports from Washington, D.C.
Today's House forum was a continuation of a proposed Bill 543 by the Democratic representative from Hawaii, Neil Abercrombie, that demands a full House debate and vote on the war. Three Republicans in the House of Representatives also endorsed such a resolution, but they were far short of votes and the debate never happened. Democratic representative from California, Maxine Waters, refers to those failed attempts in her preliminary statement.
We may be bringing the Republicans to the debate. We have been kicking and screaming, and we may be dragging them to the floor.
Democratic Representative McGovern from Massachusetts also expressed his dissatisfaction with the role Congress played in the war.
In this discussion that we're having in this committee, should be before International Relations Committee. It should be before the Defense Appropriations Committee. It should be before every committee that has anything to do with what's going on in Iraq. This Congress was complicit in the decision to go to war. This Congress did not ask questions. This Congress held nobody accountable. This Congress just went along.
A group of representatives presented their bills today that stipulate that U.S. does not intend to maintain its long-term military presence in the country. Responding to President Bush's criticism about artificial deadlines, the authors of the bills do not include any arbitrary time frame for withdrawal. Democratic Representative Tom Allen from Maine, one of the authors of the bill.
Look at what's happening on the ground. DOD is paying defense contractor KBR, a subsidiary of Halliburton, billions of dollars and pouring countless tons of concrete to build so-called enduring bases. These bases are similar to those used in the Balkans since the 1990s and have amenities such as fast food chain restaurants and DVD rental stores. It sure feels and looks like they're going to be there permanently.
Republican representatives have previously called pullout from Iraq a cowardly action. It remains to be seen if a full 17-hour discussion of the issue so wanted by the Democrats will be possible. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditska in Washington, D.C.
Massive actions, strikes, and boycotts are being planned for the 1st of May throughout the Americas. In Los Angeles, two major marches will take place, one during normal work hours, the other at 3 p.m. Nativo Lopez is the National Director for Hermandad Mexicana Latinoamericana and the National President of the Mexican American Political Association and is helping to organize the Great American Boycott.
Well, for May Day, we have planned the Great American Boycott. We work in the March 25th Coalition, which is a coalition responsible for moving a million people to Los Angeles March 25th in opposition to H.R. 4437, the Sensenbrenner bill, and demanding full and unconditional legalization for all undocumented in the United States. That day, we're asking people not to go to work, not to go to school, not to go shopping, nor to go selling things, but to participate in marches demanding the end of the Sensenbrenner bill and amnesty for all the undocumented.
Labor unions, the Catholic Church, and Spanish-language DJs Piolín and El Cucuy, meanwhile, have toned down the call to action, partly due to a fear of political backlash. Aside from missing a day's pay, some undocumented immigrant workers have also indicated they may face serious reprimands if they strike that day. Angelica Salas is with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, which is planning a massive after-work march and rally.
It's a multi-ethnic, multi-industry immigrant worker celebration of their contribution to the city of Los Angeles and their contribution to this nation. We were really intentional about being as inclusive as possible in terms of the different low-wage industries, but also in terms of all the different immigrant communities that are part of LA that actually really feel very strongly against the Sensenbrenner bill, the H.R. 4437, but most importantly, that really stand united for legalization for all workers.
Massive actions are planned throughout the United States and the Americas on May Day in support of immigrant rights. Meanwhile, protests outside the annual shareholder meeting of the world's largest gold mining company, Newmont Mining, prompted company officials to meet with activists from around the world. Demonstrators gathered outside the Denver-based company to support community activists from Ghana, Peru, and Nevada, who accused Newmont of environmental devastation, water contamination, and the displacement of thousands of people. FSRN's Maeve Conran reports from Colorado.
Padre Marcos Arañas is one of the activists from communities affected by Newmont Mining who addressed the Newmont shareholders. Father Arañas from the Cajamarca region in northern Peru described the many problems in the community which are a direct result of Newmont's activities.
Newmont came to our area about 13 years ago, and since then there have been problems related to the purchases of land. Many of the campesinos have been removed from their lands. Also, we have problems with pollution of the water and the rivers and lack of water available for the people.
Pollution of existing water sources and depletion of water tables are accusations often levied at Newmont. Daniel Owusu Korenteng is from Accra in Ghana, where a new Newmont mine is contaminating water and displacing thousands of people with little compensation. Korenteng says a slick PR campaign levied at a largely uneducated community has clouded the fact that the number of mining jobs created won't replace the number of agricultural jobs which will be lost due to the mine's construction.
Normally, mining is located in areas of high literacy and poverty. And sometimes mining companies can take advantage of those things and try to manipulate the short-term interests of communities. And that is where the problem arises, because when communities realize that in the long term, the promises and hopes are shattered.
Newmont states that it respects the social, economic and cultural rights of indigenous people. The Western Shoshone in Nevada disagree. They accuse Newmont of disregarding their rights and colluding with the U.S. government in privatizing so-called federal lands, which actually belong to the Western Shoshone. Julie Fischel is an attorney with the Western Shoshone Defense Project.
One thing we specifically talked to Newmont about last year when we were here was that their efforts to privatize those lands was one of the biggest threats facing the Shoshone people, and that they needed to hold off on any further privatization efforts. And last fall we saw a huge push through Congressman Gibbons' office and Congressman Pombo's office to do exactly what we had talked to Newmont about not doing.
Following yesterday's peaceful protest outside the shareholders' meeting, Newmont CEO Wayne Murty met with the activists from Peru, Ghana and Western Shoshone people to hear their concerns about Newmont's activities. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran in Denver.
Pakistan's President General Pervez Musharraf has called Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, urging him to go ahead with the proposed Iran-Pakistan-India gas pipeline, even if India has cold feet. The United States is not happy with the project because it involves Iran, and some media has reported that Washington is distancing itself from General Musharraf because of his defiance as well as his criticism of the U.S.-India nuclear deal. FSRN's Masroor Hussein has more from Islamabad.
President Musharraf is faced with a multitude of threats from the Islamist parties, who recently flexed their street power over the cartoons issue, jihadi groups fighting against the regular army in South Waziristan, and a growing secessionist movement in Balochistan province. In this background, leaders of two liberal democratic parties, Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, whom Musharraf has accused of massive corruption, announced to form a political alliance against him. I asked former Foreign Secretary Tanveer Ahmed Khan what was the future of Bush's closest ally, Musharraf.
He has a very strong backing from the Pakistan army, and there is political tussle. But at the moment, there is every evidence that General Pervez Musharraf intends to hold on to power, has no intention of giving it up for the next 5 or 6 years. And therefore, I think the working assumption at this point of time is that he would be at the helm of affairs unless some entirely unforeseen and untoward incident takes place.
Political threats aside, General Musharraf is viewed by the common folk as a benign dictator who is good for the country and someone who is daring to stand up against America. Suhail Rabbani is Vice President of Islamabad Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
No doubt, as a president, General Musharraf definitely contributed a lot for the common people. He is good for the country, made major changes. He tried to create facilities for common people. However, it is essential. And to pass on benefits to common people, he needs to bring about major changes in his team. He should not be worried. If you ask me about Musharraf's role in Bush's war against terrorism, let me tell you, America needs General Musharraf as frontline ally.
But recent media reports from the United States say that Washington was distancing itself from General Musharraf. Professor Khalid Mahmood is a senior researcher and political activist.
Although there have been of late, there have been some indications of U.S. Not being as supportive of Musharraf regime as they were before. And some of the reasons were Musharraf regime is not prepared to go along with the Americans in their Iran adventure. One quite clear indication that so far both India and Pakistan have said that they will go ahead with the gas pipeline project, despite the American clearly saying that they are opposed to it.
The questions asked in the Pakistan media and public discussions in Islamabad focus on how will Musharraf react if the United States decided to launch strikes against Iranian nuclear installations. Tanveer Ahmed Khan again.
The best or the worst that Islamabad can do is to remain neutral. I don't think even President Musharraf, who is the closest ally that Pakistan has produced as far as the United States is concerned, I don't think even he can ignore the public sort of indignation or disapproval of a military action against Iran and join it.
Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
The move by Uganda's government to seek permission from the UN to enter the Democratic Republic of Congo has sparked debate and fears that it's another scheme to secure a diplomatic invasion to plunder mineral resources in the DRC. As Emmanuel Okela reports from Kampala, the decision is raising eyebrows from both the Congolese government and the Ugandan parliament.
Ugandan Minister of Defense Amama Mbabazi and Foreign Affairs Minister Sam Kutesa recently met with the UN Security Council to discuss the matter. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is also engaging his Congolese counterpart, Joseph Kabila, into a temporary pact to allow Ugandan troops to pursue rebels of the Lord's Resistance Army, LRA, who are said to be building bases in the Garamba Forest, northeast of the DRC. But Congo is hesitant. It's in a once-beaten, twice-shy scenario. Uganda in 1998 entered Congo ostensibly in a sizzling chase of rebels of the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF. The 2 years stay ended in allegations that were later confirmed by the UN investigators that top Ugandan soldiers advantaged themselves to loot minerals and timber during the intrusion. The new proposal is also casting doubt from the Ugandan parliament, which is enraged that the Museveni administration is again planning to take troops to Congo without consulting it. Mr. Kumregan, a member of parliament from the war-ravaged northern Uganda, says such clandestine moves raise suspicion.
The first time they went to Congo was clandestinely. They took a lot of soldiers and home guards from northern Uganda, and they abandoned fighting the war in northern Uganda and went and squandered resources in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which eventually was very unfortunate. Again, they have started the same trend.
Uganda claims LRA is recruiting through abductions in southern Sudan and the Congo, posing grave security threat in the three countries. 3 years ago, Sudan allowed Uganda to enter its territory and hunt down LRA fighters. Uganda's defense minister, Mr. Mama Mbabazi, says Congo should also comply since the mission will be supervised by the UN military observer in Congo, MONUC. He says Uganda has a duty to protect its people from the rebel atrocities of LRA.
Responsible government can allow a situation like what we are experiencing here. This is the fourth attack from Congo by armed people. They have been killing people at the border, and we have a responsibility to protect them.
Critics of the move insist that Uganda should instead pursue peace talks with the rebels and lessen on the military option. They argue that entering Congo is no guarantee in ending the 20-year rebellion by the LRA. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela, reporting in Kampala, Uganda.
One day after her brother called for Iraq's Sunni insurgency to be brought down with force, the sister of Iraq's new vice president, Tariq al-Hashemi, was gunned down in a drive-by shooting today in Baghdad. While news of her death is grabbing international headlines, no one is immune from the violence of Iraq's guerrilla war. The Ministry of Education reports that between October of last year and the end of February, 400 teachers and employees from the ministry have been killed, 170 have been wounded, and 417 schools were attacked. Some were shut down. FSRN's David Enders is in Baghdad. He files this report.
Students file back to class after recess at Dijla Elementary School in Mansour, on Baghdad's west side. In October, the school was hit by a mortar round, killing one student and injuring 10. The school has kept the classroom the mortar struck closed since then because, the principal says, the students are too afraid to go back into the classroom. Many students have left the school because their parents keep them home or have left the country. 11-year-old Amin Khaldun was in the classroom when the mortar hit.
My parents gave me the choice to quit school because of the situation. I insisted to continue because I am a good student. We want to live in peace like American students and to have the right to our childhood.
In addition to the threat of violence, Iraq's school system, despite reconstruction efforts, remains in need of 4,500 new schools. Fala al-Qarashi, an assistant to the general director of the Ministry of Education, complains that money is being spent to hire guards rather than build new schools. But teachers complain that the guards aren't armed. Jalal Yassin Al-Nakesh is a teacher at Al-Mansour Teachers College, a specialized high school for students who want to teach. One of the school's buses was attacked on the way to school last month, killing the driver.
The Ministry of Education is not helping with the security situation. We have about 1,250 students in our institute, and the guards were not armed. We collected donations from our salaries to buy weapons for the security guards.
Nakash also says that inflation has finally caught up with teachers' salaries, which were raised from an average of $5 a month before the war to at least $100 per month afterward, a move cited as a great success by the Bush administration. Nakash, who has been teaching for more than 25 years, is in the top tier of salary earners, making about $330, or 500,000 dinar each month. He says he now spends 100,000 dinars each month on electricity from a generator shared by his neighborhood. Nakash says the quality of education for future teachers is also suffering as instructors try to accommodate students who miss school more often than before because of roadblocks and other daily traffic hassles, or because they have lost a family member or friend, as it increasingly seems everyone in Baghdad has.
Because of the security situation, we tried to facilitate things for the students. But if we were working on our regular system, at least 50% of the students probably would not have passed.
There have been reports of sectarian tensions entering schools, including fights between teachers and teachers from one sect giving bad marks to students of another. But most teachers interviewed said they were making a concerted effort to combat sectarian rhetoric and that education was the best weapon. But even the best efforts by teachers might not be enough. At Tariq bin Ziyad High School, Principal Rad Abdul-Jabbar says enrollment at his school has risen from 320 last year to 620 this year, as parents from around the neighborhood insist on sending their children to a school close by rather than one that requires busing. This trend is being repeated all over the city and exacerbated by the influx of displaced Shiites from Baghdad's suburbs. But Jabbar's greatest problem remains that so many of his students have been affected by Baghdad's rampant kidnappings, assassinations, and random deaths.
As a result, of course, they don't see why they are studying or preparing themselves for the future, as the future is very ambiguous now.
In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.